gave Sobel's voice the finger. Let him talk. Merritt had to conserve ammunition. It was time to orient himself. He pulled a laminated floor plan card of Sobel's house from his chest pocket. It was warped from the heat of the fire, but still legible. Merritt found his location and realized he wasn't far from the cellar door and the pit that swallowed the bomb disposal robot. Merritt looked up and noticed the silence. What's the matter, Sobel? Run out of things to say? The voice spoke from the same place, right in front of him.
I didn't catch that.
I said, cat got your tongue?
I didn't catch that.
It couldn't really understand him. This was all an elaborate technological trick, a logic tree with weaponry. Dead retard. Merritt pocketed the card and put a shoulder behind the heavy armoire, trying to push it ahead of him. It insisted on being stationary. He took a step back to look at it. He'd seen railroad trestles built with less wood. It looked a century old, and its shelves were lined with Talavera plates and wooden carvings of Dia de los Muertos figurines. Merritt smiled humorlessly at the little skeletons cavorting and going about their daily business, apparently unaffected by their demise. Real cute. He grabbed a bronze candlestick off the shelf and looked ahead of him. A 20-foot stretch of barren hall lay before him. After that, he'd be at the doorway opening onto the billiards room, which led to the cellar door. He slung the shotgun and got down onto his belly, spreading his weight over the tile floor. He turned back to rap the hollow floor behind him to get a sense for its sound. Then he rapped the floor under him. Solid. Very different sound. Merritt faced forward again, and he started crawling, cautiously rapping on the floor with the heavy candlestick as he went. Merritt was halfway along the open stretch of hall when Sobel's voice spoke again a foot or so in front of Merritt's face.
I hate to interrupt, but now I have to kill you.
Merritt heard something from deep inside the house. It sounded like a sump pump, only many times larger than the one in Merritt's house. The sound of water coursing through pipes came to his ears, and suddenly, water began to silently spread out across the floor from an unseen vent beneath the baseboards. Then Merritt glanced left, right, and back behind him. The water was coming at him from ahead and behind, spreading out from the walls across the tile floor about a half inch deep. Merritt got up into a crouch, not sure what to do next. He'd never reached the armoire before the water overtook him. And what could the water do anyway? Sobel could never fill this room. There were 6 or 7 doorways leading into it. Merritt started scanning the walls for hidden danger, and he quickly found it. Ahead of him, one of the electrical outlets in the wall suddenly extended out and down onto the floor. It was mounted on the end of a curved bar. A zap and pop were audible as the socket hit the surface of the water, which was now electrified. Shit! Merritt leaped to his feet and looked around for something to stand on. Nothing. He quickly flipped the shotgun from his back and blasted 2 holes in the lath and plaster wall near him, one about a foot from the floor and another at hand-holding height. He let the shotgun fall on its shoulder strap as he jumped, latching on to the jagged edges of the holes just as water collided beneath him from both directions. Merritt almost lost his grip as the thin slats of broken wood snapped under his weight, but he soon found studs and cross braces to cling to. He took a deep breath and leaned his burned face against the cool plaster. He was really starting to feel the pain of his burns now. Second-degree burns were the worst for pain. He collected himself, then glanced beneath him. The water was now about 3 inches deep on the floor and was draining through the seams of several pits. The cascade of water echoed below the floor. More water was constantly being pumped in, but it appeared to have found equilibrium. The humming sound of the electrified surface was unnerving. Merritt looked ahead. He was only 8 feet or so from the billiard room doorway, and there was a step up, so the water was not rushing into it. Merritt began ripping out lath slats and kicking in the plaster wall ahead of him. His bulletproof gloves and armored knuckle plates helped as he repeatedly punched the cracked edge of the rapidly expanding hole. The debris fell into the buzzing water below. It took him a good 5 minutes, but he was soon at the edge of the billiard room doorway. He leaned over to gaze inside. It contained twin pool tables and a bar that would suffice for a small town. He immediately considered the many ways this room could kill him. High-speed billiard balls fired from an antique cannon. Molotov cocktails of 20-year-old scotch. Asbestos poisoning. Choking hazards. He couldn't begin to guess. Even at this distance, Merritt could see one of the acoustic weapon sensors up near the ceiling. He unholstered his pistol with his right hand while holding on to a wooden beam with the other. He raised the gun, aimed carefully, and sent three shots into the pod. Parts of it fell to the carpeted floor at the foot of the bar. Merritt stared at the room. What the hell? He unhooked a flashbang grenade from his web harness. The grenade handle was melted onto the webbing, but he managed to pull it off. He struggled to remove the pin while still holding on to the beam. Most people thought you could pull the pin with your teeth, but that was a great way to crack a tooth or blast your head off, or both. He finally wrapped his hand around the beam and pulled the pin out with his forefinger. He tossed the grenade into the center of the nearest pool table, then he ducked around the corner. The blast was deafening, even at this distance. The beams of the house shook, and he heard lots of shattering glass. He hoped it would confuse any infrared or acoustical sensors. Merritt swung around the corner and ran headlong toward the nearest table, whose felt top was scorched and smoking from the blast. Merritt lunged onto the tabletop and rolled over its far edge. Then he rolled over the next one as well, landing like a cat, crouched and ready for action with the shotgun. He covered the last 10 feet to the opposite doorway and slammed his body against the wall there. He was breathing hard, but then again, his heart had been beating 180 times a minute since he entered the house. The telltale sound of acoustical weapons powering up reached him. He aimed upwards and blasted the pod into plastic confetti that rained down on him. He scanned the ceiling, but none of the other pods seemed threatening. The cellar door was 4 feet ahead and to his left. The floor before it was terracotta tile, but he knew it concealed the pit that had swallowed the FBI's bomb disposal robot. He looked for seams, but the pit was well concealed. Merritt stood back at the edge of the short hall, then leaned forward and depressed the cellar's levered door handle with the shotgun barrel. Suddenly, a 4-foot section of floor in front of the cellar door fell away, revealing a brick-lined pit splashing with water. The tip of a robot arm extended above the water's surface. Merritt quickly jumped to the far side of the pit, then leaned forward and grabbed the cellar door handle. He pried the door open as it resisted. He shoved the shotgun behind the door, pointing at the top hinge. Boom! The top of the door fell away from the wall, and with a little twisting and kicking, the other hinge ripped off. The door fell into the pit, smacking the water with its flat face. Merritt looked into the doorway and could see the top of a flight of steps leading downward. A barred gate blocked his path. They were stainless steel bars like the kind found on the inner door of a bank vault. A numeric keypad was set into the steel strike plate. The voice spoke, this time right behind Merritt's head.
Dave, stop. Stop, Dave.
Fuck off, Sobel. Merritt concentrated on the keypad and the strike plate. He was no security specialist, and he knew it was probably booby-trapped. He aimed the shotgun at an angle and squeezed off a Hatton round into the strike plate. The lead and wax slug disintegrated into a pall of smoke. Merritt waved it away and looked at the strike plate. The keypad was entirely gone, leaving behind only a small round hole where its electronics entered the steel gate mechanism. Otherwise, the strike plate was undamaged. Hot lead was useless against it. Merritt unholstered his second P-14 pistol. He'd give hot copper a try. Merritt aimed at the strike plate, then fired repeatedly at the same spot. Bullet holes appeared in the far wall as they ricocheted. After the last shot, he inspected the damage. 14 shots, and he had successfully dulled the finish. Barely. Merritt sank down to lean his back against the wall. Wackauer and the others had been carrying the heavy-duty breaching kit, the cutting charges and boosters. All Merritt had was a roll of strip explosives, and that wouldn't take out this steel gate. Sobel's voice was right there with him.
Does it help to know that there is nothing important here?
Merritt looked down into the watery pit. He examined its walls. They were of brick, painted with thick black marine paint. The pit was on the same level as the rest of the cellar, and presumably the server room. Merritt holstered his pistol and took the remaining grenades from his web harness. He had 4 flashbang grenades left. He took the roll of primasheet and det cord from his thigh pocket and wrapped them tightly around the grenades. Then he stood, straddling the corner of the pit. He dropped the package into the water, reeling out the detonator cord as it fell. Then he ducked around the corner and activated the detonator. The muffled blast shot a geyser of water into the ceiling. The floor trembled for a few moments. Merritt soon heard the sound of water rushing through an opening. He had cracked the brick wall. He came back to the edge of the pit and could see water draining through the wall and into the server room. A klaxon suddenly sounded in the house, and fire strobes flickered on the ceiling. A British female voice spoke on a regular PA system.
Primary data center penetrated. Commencing self-destruct sequence.
There was a pause.
And there is no countdown.
Shit. Merritt knew the front door was around the corner and down the front hall. He sprinted around the corner as a piercing beep filled the house. It was like a smoke detector on steroids, drilling into his brain. The sprinkler caps popped off in the ceiling above him, and sprinkler heads clicked down. He heard the hiss of pressure building up. Merritt looked ahead. The front door of the mansion still stood wide open, about 100 feet ahead, wedged open by that blessed bomb squad team. He sprinted for the opening with everything he had. The sprinkler heads came to life, spraying gasoline over the stylish decor. He was still 60 feet from the front door when he saw a bright halogen bulb start to burn intensely up near the ceiling in the foyer. The light grew so intense that Merritt couldn't look directly at it. When the bulb exploded, sending a wall of flame roaring toward him, Merritt's brain trotted forward, a candidate for his last mortal thought. I'll never see my daughters grow up. Without warning, the floor gave way beneath him as he ran. A pit trap swallowed him. He fell into blackness, chased by flames that lit up the brackish water. Time slowed down. And Merritt had the leisure to consider what a bastard Sobel was. He'd activated a pit trap after letting the bomb disposal robot drive down the hallway safely. The devious bastard. Merritt hit the water face first and blacked out as the trap door snapped shut above him. Among the agents surrounding the mansion, a shout went up. It was quickly followed by hundreds of other voices shouting. Sobel's mansion was now glowing orange. Then, flames burst out through literally all of its windows. In seconds, the entire structure was engulfed in flames reaching 50 feet into the air. The half-dozen outbuildings burst into flames too and were quickly roaring infernos. Trier numbly watched the scene. It was the nightmarish Waco visual he'd dreaded. One almost certainly combined with the worst casualties ever suffered by the FBI in a single operation. And all of Sobel's data was going up in flames, along with Trier's career. Chapter 19, Sarcophagus. It took Greg nearly 3.5 hours to crack the WPA key on Borner's second Wi-Fi network. He had to keep his car running the entire time to be certain he didn't drain his laptop battery. Once he cracked the key, he configured his card to use it, and DHCP soon handed him an IP address on the wireless network. By that time, it was roughly 4 in the morning. But he'd slept a little, and buoyed by the successful crack, he felt good. If this was a test, he'd passed the first part. He might get out of this alive yet. Greg used Superscan to run a ping sweep and port scan for machines on this new network, but he discovered only the single workstation running the wireless access point. The workstation returned information on its operating system and coughed up the status of several running services, but its hard drive was sealed tight. Greg considered his options. He wanted a quick exploit that would give him a remote shell on the host machine with sysadmin rights. From there, he should be able to see into the hardwired LAN not yet visible to him. Since he didn't have the luxury of time, he opted for an attack that was effective against a wide range of devices, SNMP, a buffer overrun that exploited a known vulnerability in unpatched implementations of Simple Network Management Protocol. This service was present on the target, and it was worth a shot. He switched to the command console and quickly keyed in the commands, pointing his exploit code to port 161 on the target machine. If the target was running an unpatched OpenBSD, he'd get to root pretty quick. He executed the command, waited, and in a moment, he got a return instructing him to telnet to port 6161 at the target IP address. He sighed in relief. Another hurdle overcome. Greg launched a telnet session and soon had a root prompt. He now owned Borner's workstation. Time to escalate network privileges. Greg searched the target machine's domain, but was disappointed by the results. His victim was linked to a single server, and that was sealed up tight. It barely divulged any information. Greg took a look in the server's shared directory and raised his eyebrows. The directory contained a single web page file, a page named hackme.htm. Greg smiled. He was beginning to feel a connection with Sobel. Sobel wanted him to get this far. That's what this was all about. Greg double-clicked on the file. A plain white web page appeared in a browser window. It had logon and password text boxes and a submit button, nothing more. There were options here. Unicode directory transversal? Greg smiled. Log on. Sobel was encouraging him. This had all the earmarks of an SQL injection attack, and he had a favorite one. In the logon and password boxes, he entered apostrophe or 1=1... He clicked the submit button. After a moment's pause, an animation appeared with the words, "Logon successful. Please wait." Greg felt a rush of endorphins. He'd just received high praise from his new mentor. He was getting more comfortable by the minute in this environment. In a few moments, a slick flash-based diagram of a cinder block building appeared with various features highlighted. It was an isometric view depicting the building right in front of Greg's car. He could see the antenna tower with a call-out label captioned Wi-Fi Antenna Array. He moved his pointer around the diagram and noticed rollovers come to life as his mouse passed over certain features. Greg saw a sensor array depicted on the roof, and the illustration looked like it included at least one camera. Greg pointed at the array, and a translucent drop-down menu unfolded to the right of it containing a submenu. Ultra-wideband transceiver, HD video multiplexer, acoustical sensor array. He was beginning to feel the rush now. This wasn't a game, and it was clearly designed by a well-funded and technologically capable person. He had always sought the edge, and this was it. This was as far from Main Street as he'd ever been. This wasn't the tattooed, pierced, neo-tribal, rebellious bullshit of his generation. This was a quiet demonstration of networked power. This was it. Greg selected HD Video Multiplexer from the drop-down menu. A new browser window appeared containing a selection of 6 thumbnail images. They appeared to be streaming video feeds. Greg saw an image of a car in one thumbnail, and he double-clicked on it, as anyone his age would do. It expanded to fill the window. It was a live image of his car. He waved his hand, and his hand appeared waving on the video feed. Greg noticed a superimposed red bracket around his license plate. A call-out label showed the software's interpretation of the tag number. It was correct. So Sobel was employing an optical license plate reader. Greg knew it was commercially available software, used all the time on interstates and downtown roads. But Sobel needed access to DMV records to determine who owned the car. He must have cracked a DMV database in order to get his registration information. Greg considered the hourly rate of the average DMV worker and realized that gaining access wasn't a problem for Sobel. In the background of the video, there was a similar bracket around the VW Vanagon's license plate. Greg couldn't help but wonder what was up with that. The van was smashed all to hell. He closed that dialog box and checked out the other video feeds. There were cameras placed all around the cinderblock building, guarding it from every direction. Every time the wind blew, the swaying branches were outlined by vectored lines, trying to resolve into something recognized by the software. Greg found himself watching the red lines appear and disappear like a lava lamp. Motion capture software? This was sophisticated stuff. No one would ever suspect that this isolated blockhouse held so much processing power. Greg closed the video feeds and moved around to the other visible features of the diagram. He noticed that a garage-like protrusion extended from the rear of the building. He pointed his mouse at it, and the words H1 Alpha materialized beneath his pointer. That explained the damage to the Vanagon. There was an automated Hummer here, just like at Sobel's mansion. Greg smiled. It was Sobel. He was walking in the footsteps of a genius. To his dismay, there was no more information visible for the Hummer, so he clicked on one of the nodes around the base of the building. The label, Seismic Sensors, appeared, probably for detection of approaching vehicles and people. As Greg scrolled around the base of the building illustration, a rollover displayed the red, glowing outline of a door in the front wall. He looked up at the real wall some 20 feet ahead of him. He couldn't see any indication that there was a door in the plain cinder blocks. He hovered his mouse cursor back over the section of wall in the diagram, and a drop-down menu appeared. It had two selections, open and close. Greg clicked open. In front of his car, he saw a section of the cinder block wall move inward, then slide sideways, revealing a dark doorway about 5 feet wide. Greg half expected rolling steam to emanate from the opening. It was outlined with a soft red glow. Was this it? Was he supposed to enter? He looked around warily. That would require getting out of his car. The spotlight from the building still shined down on the area, revealing what a horrendous morass of mud he'd driven into. He had no idea how he'd get the car out without a tow truck. He couldn't stay in here forever. Greg shut down his laptop and packed up all his gear. In a few minutes, he had everything in his rucksack except for his Glock 9mm, which he kept in his right hand. Greg opened the Tempo's driver door with its trademark 1980s Detroit crack squeak sound. He gingerly placed one combat-booted foot into the quagmire and felt it sink up to his knee. He groaned in disgust, but realizing he had no choice, he followed it with his other foot, closing the car door behind him. Pretty soon, he was stagger-stepping through the deep mud toward the dark opening in the cinder block wall. Greg stopped and took another look at the smashed VW Vanagon with Louisiana plates and Anarchy bumper stickers. Shattered taillight plastic and twisted side moldings littered the area. The left rear wheel of the VW was smashed into immobility, set at an angle to the axle. The passenger door of the Vanagon was slightly open, with deep footprints leading out of the mud and toward the road. Greg stood for a moment, deciding whether to check it out. He realized he didn't want to be walking around out here and continued staggering through the foot-sucking mud toward the building. Before long, he climbed up onto a ledge of solid ground that ringed the building. Greg examined his legs. They were caked in mud. His feet were sopping wet. He tried to scrape the mud off his boots by dragging them against the ground, but gave up and slung his rucksack over his shoulder. Then he chambered around in the Glock and faced the opening. Diffuse red light emanated from the edges of the door. It was just enough light to reveal a polished stone floor extending into the blackness beyond. Red. Low-frequency light not visible from any significant distance. Suddenly, a British-accented female voice spoke in midair right alongside Greg's head.
"Come inside, Mr. Greg."
Greg was so startled he reflexively squeezed off a shot with the Glock. The deafening crack echoed off into the sky. The bullet whined off the cinder block wall, then howled out into the woods. The female voice spoke again. It sounded slightly artificial, clipped.
"Are you familiar with gunshot detectors? Police departments in major U.S. cities deploy them to identify and triangulate the precise location of gunshots the moment they occur. A gunshot has a distinct acoustic pattern. Even the weapon fired can be identified by its sound pattern. You apparently have a 9mm.
There was a pause.
You won't need it. You've earned the right to enter.
Greg looked down at the Glock in his hand. He took a breath. He'd never felt out of his depth technologically, but the disembodied voice was as close to magic as he'd ever experienced. He didn't like the role of awed primitive. It didn't suit him. He took another deep breath and tentatively spoke to the voice. Who are you? The voice shot back.
This door will close permanently in 10 seconds.
Greg's thoughts scattered, and he hesitated for a moment before rushing through the doorway and into the darkness, feet squishing mud. The moment he did so, the door slid noiselessly closed behind him. The red glow from the doorframe faded away as the opening sealed shut. Greg stood in pitch-black darkness for a moment. It smelled not at all musty. It was super clean, dry, filtered air. He wasn't in South Texas anymore. Suddenly, a diffuse white light began to emanate from the walls. It didn't flicker on like fluorescent lights, but steadily rose from nothing to a comfortable, even glow. It was confident, effortless light, and completely silent. Greg found himself in a room 20 feet square, with a single steel door set in the middle of the wall straight ahead of him. The door had a dappled gunmetal look to its surface, as though it were meant to draw the eye. The walls in here were all glowing white panels, made of some nylon or fiberglass material. The floor was simple, polished concrete. The voice came back suddenly, startling Greg as it circled around him. Greg was hearing it, but he was still having difficulty accepting it. In real life, a voice couldn't appear in thin air. It wasn't possible.
You've come a long way, and you've accomplished much.
A pause.
Don't be frightened by my voice. Its appearance in midair is accomplished through a hypersonic sound system. This technology is commercially available. Would you like to hear a technical explanation? Yes or no?
Greg looked around at the ceiling and walls. There were tiny plastic pods of various sorts mounted there. He cleared his throat. Yes.
A hypersonic sound system, or HSS, does not use physical speakers. HSS pulsates quartz crystals at a frequency thousands of times faster than the vibrations in a normal speaker, creating ultrasonic waves at frequencies far beyond human hearing. Unlike lower frequency sound, these waves travel in a tight path, a beam. Two beams can be focused to intersect each other, and where they interact, they produce a third sonic wave whose frequency is exactly the difference between the two original sounds. In HSS, that difference will fall within the range of human hearing and will appear to come from thin air. This is known as a Tartini tone, in honor of Giuseppe Tartini, the 18th century Italian composer who first discovered this principle.
Greg was feeling slightly faint.
This is only the beginning of what you will learn. You do wish to learn, don't you?
Yes, he blurted.
Then we must determine your sincerity.
The whir of a precise electrical motor came to his ears, and Greg glanced around the room. A small console had opened up in the wall next to the door. Greg warily approached it, his feet squishing mud onto the concrete floor. He saw no other muddy prints. He must have been the first to make it this far. A smile stole across his face, and he approached the console with more courage. The console appeared to be an array of biometric devices, a handprint reader, a camera lens with a rubber viewfinder, and a microphone. There was also a small LCD screen, like the type found on the backs of airline seats. It was not illuminated. The voice was right next to him.
Place either hand on the reader. Place your eye against the viewfinder and adjust the microphone to a position approximately 3 inches to the right of your mouth.
Greg did as instructed. It was not the most comfortable setup, but he didn't think complaining was a good idea.
Very good. Is English your primary language? Answer yes or no.
Greg cleared his throat. Yes.
Good. I am going to ask a series of questions. You must answer truthfully, even if you think the truth is not the optimal response. This is not a test of your skills as a hacker. It is an effort to determine if you bear us ill will. A pattern of falsehoods will terminate the test. Early termination of the test will cause the air to be pumped from the room. This will create a partial vacuum that will cause the nitrogen to bubble out of your blood, resulting in an excruciating death. An MPEG video of your death will be placed on the internet as a warning to others. Do you understand? Answer yes or no.
Fuck! Greg pulled his head up from the viewfinder and looked back at the featureless cinder block wall.
Stop!
The voice was so loud that it actually hurt. Then it returned to a comfortable volume.
Your earlier work was impressive. Your future lies ahead of you, not behind you. Please return your eye to the viewfinder.
There was a pause.
I will not ask you a second time.
Greg was suddenly sweating. He felt his palm damp against the hand reader as he quickly returned his eye to the viewfinder. Fuck, fuck, fuck.
Stop talking until you are asked a question.
Greg bit his lip and couldn't stop shaking. The phrase, excruciating death, kept running through his mind. This was not an idiot he was dealing with here. He was the idiot, and he was truly afraid.
Answer truthfully or die. Do you know who built this place? Yes or no?
Yes.
Speak the name slowly. First name, then last.
Matthew Sobel.
Do you dislike Mr. Sobel? Yes or no?
No.
Do you admire Mr. Sobel? Yes or no?
Yes, very much.
Answer just yes or no.
The sweating returned. Yes. Jesus H. fucking Christ.
Would you be interested in playing an active role in Mr. Sobel's plans?
Yes.
If you were generously rewarded with power, knowledge and wealth, would you be willing to break the law and expose yourself to personal risk as required to fulfill the plans of Mr. Sobel?
He didn't hesitate. Yes.
Do you believe in God?
No.
Would you be willing to follow the instructions of a dead person?
The feelings welling up inside of him surprised even Greg. Here he was, strapped to the polygraph from hell, and he still hated taking orders from anyone. And yes, he had a subtle prejudice against the dead. They had no skin in the game. Sobel was impressive, but Greg wasn't going to spend the rest of his fucking life serving a macro on steroids. God damn it.
Answer yes or no.
Fuck. No. Greg closed his eyes and waited to die.
Keep your eyes open.
He complied immediately. There was a pause.
To clarify, your powerful intellect will be required to define the precise path to reach objectives set by Mr. Sobel. There will be a considerable degree of freedom in the means. The outcome will be all that matters. Knowing this, would you still have a problem performing in this role? Yes or no?
Relief flooded over him. No.
Would you be willing to direct others in the pursuit of Mr. Sobel's goals, possibly resulting in the deaths of these subordinates?
No problem, he thought, then said, yes.
Do you have knowledge of a warrant out for your arrest in any state, territory, protectorate, or nation?
No.
Do you have a criminal record in any state, territory, protectorate, or nation?
No.
Do you take drugs?
No.
Do you have any significant medical condition or physical limitation?
No.
Are you currently in a significant romantic relationship?
No.
Do you have pressing family obligations?
No.
Do you have a history of mental illness?
Yes.
Have you ever purposely caused the death of another person?
Greg paused. Yes. He never really took ownership of it before. He felt a strange pang of guilt that surprised him. It passed quickly.
Are you available to begin work immediately?
Yes. Greg shrugged. Apparently this wasn't a typical organization. There was silence. It was deafening. Then...
Mr. Greg, you may lift your head from the viewfinder and remove your hand from the reader. Your convictions appear genuine. You are now under our protection. The remaining test is to determine your service rank and is a modified intelligence quotient exam. It was designed to assess your knowledge of human psychology, logic, mathematics, language, and your ability to think creatively while under pressure. It is not possible to fail this test, but performing well on it will greatly increase your personal power and the opportunities for your faction.
The LCD screen glowed to life, presenting a simple web page with a crocus yellow background and a large title in Times New Roman font. Faction Multiphasic Assessment Battery. A start button appeared just beneath the title. The voice spoke again.
This test will take several hours. You will be judged on both the accuracy and speed of your answers. Use the touch screen to enter your selections. You may return to any question to change an answer, although you will be penalized for doing so. When you are ready to begin, press the start button.
Greg took a look around, shrugged his shoulders, and clicked start. It wound up taking Greg 3 hours and 12 minutes to complete the multiphasic battery, at the end of which his legs were lead and his back was killing him from hunching over. Worst of all, his brain felt sucked dry. He'd never been presented with such a grueling test of his intellect. The questions ranged from simple memory retention and spatial relationships to intense cryptographic theory. There were brutally complex logic problems, elaborate tautological diagrams, and language math. The most enjoyable questions were the ones on social engineering. Greg felt extremely confident of his answers there. In fact, he felt confident about most of the exam. He was just emotionally and intellectually spent. He expected to see a test score or something at the end, but instead, a simple web page announced the completion of the exam and the amount of time elapsed. 3 hours, 12 minutes. Greg stared at the little LCD screen, wondering what to do next. The voice returned, startling Greg.
You scored very well, Mr. Greg, and your rank will reflect this. You are now the founding member of a faction. Welcome.
The steel door next to the console clanked and moved inward, then noiselessly slid aside, revealing another dimly lit room beyond. Greg grabbed his rucksack. He didn't even bother to draw his pistol. He walked confidently through the door. This room was perhaps 30 feet long and 20 feet wide. It looked more like a pagan temple than anything else. Four stone pillars supported the relatively low arched ceiling. The floors were of polished granite, and a half dozen pedestals covered with chrome or stainless steel domes were set about the room. Soft, almost imperceptible white light suffused the chamber. Straight ahead at the far wall was a dais, whereupon sat a wide, high-definition plasma screen television. As Greg moved forward, dried mud cracking off his boots, he saw a man in his early to mid-30s displayed on the plasma screen. The man's hawkish features were accentuated by piercing blue eyes. His hair was light brown and neatly groomed. He wore a crisp linen shirt and was viewed in medium close-up with his hands held in front of him, fingers interleaved in quiet repose, staring straight at Greg as he approached the dais. As Greg came into a circle set into the granite floor, the man nodded solemnly to him in greeting. Even if Greg hadn't seen the photos on the news, he would have known this man instantly. It was Matthew Sobel. Greg buckled to his knees on the stone floor before him. For the first time in his life, Greg finally understood what a cathedral was. It was a psychological hack. Sobel was there, larger than life in perfect digital clarity. He extended his arms in a gesture of welcome.
Few have accomplished what you have. You're a rare person. But then, you know that.
Sobel let the words sink in.
While I lived, I could not father a son. But in death, I will. What things I could teach you, were you my son. What pride I would have had in you.
Greg's eyes welled with tears. He felt emotion from a place he'd long forgotten. Memories of his father and long years seeking approval never granted bubbled up from the depths of his mind. Sobel continued,
I wish I could have met you. You who will be my eyes, my ears, and my hands. My growing power will course through you. I will protect you, like any father protects his beloved son.
Greg saw in Sobel's eyes the respect and compassion he had always sought. The acceptance for who and what he was. This was home. Greg was finally home. He wept openly. He was filled with joy for the first time in his life. Nothing else mattered to him anymore. Sobel looked on.
There is so much I wish to teach you.
Chapter 20, Speaking with the Dead. It was a perfect autumn dawn. The hills were shrouded in the mist that usually burned off by mid-morning, and the glowing orb of the sun silhouetted the columns of SUVs heading south on the 101. An earthy fragrance, sent aloft by 100,000 lawn sprinklers, filled the air, and a constant airy rush, like the sound of falling water or wind in the trees, echoed across the valley from the freeway. Southern California was booting up for another day, as long as the power grid held. John Ross strode across the pavement of his hotel parking lot, dressed impeccably in a black pinstriped four-button suit and a gray silk tie. His black leather laptop bag was slung over one shoulder. Ross preferred corporate resident suites like this. They usually had open parking lots and direct access front doors. It was more like a regular apartment and less like a hotel. He almost felt like a resident of Woodland Hills. He breathed in deeply, appreciating the morning air. Was that the smell of jasmine? Ross stopped short. Detective Seebeck leaned on the hood of Ross's silver Audi sedan and sipped takeout coffee while reading the Ventura Star. He didn't even look up. Morning, John. Ross resumed walking toward his car, but more slowly. Good morning, Sergeant. Do you normally get up this early? I could ask you the same thing. As Ross walked past, Seebeck folded the paper and threw it down on the car hood in front of him. The headline screamed, Second Massacre at Sobel Estate, in a font size normally reserved for advertisements or declarations of war. Ross didn't pick it up. I live in the Western Hemisphere. It would have been difficult to miss. Seebeck stabbed a thick finger toward a sidebar story elsewhere on page one. Ross cocked his head to read, Sobel funeral today. He looked back up at Seebeck. Seebeck flipped Ross's lapel. Dressed a little mournfully, aren't you? Ross was taken aback. The cop was perceptive. Ross dropped his formality and nodded in acknowledgement. It seemed odd to me, his having a viewing. He doesn't strike me as the religious type. No kidding. So why are you trying to shake me by ducking out early? Ross looked down at the parking lot and squeezed his laptop bag shoulder strap rhythmically. I don't want my name to wind up in the news. Seebeck considered this, Is that what all this is about? You're afraid of Sobel? As a computer consultant, the demon might consider me a threat. Seebeck nodded. All right. We'll keep our collaboration secret. But if you're going to pursue Sobel anyway, remember, I can open doors for you, and you for me. Ross breathed the morning air deeply again as he pondered the offer. He looked up. What do you hope to accomplish that the FBI can't? You tell me. They stared at each other for a moment more until Ross nodded. Who knows I'm working with you? The better question is, who would care in all this insanity? Pete, please. The FBI knows, but I'd be surprised if Trier is thinking about that this morning. They lost a hostage rescue team last night. I'm not going to meet with the FBI computer forensics team. Tell Trier I pushed out. No problem. Seebeck looked him in the eye. You made the right call at the estate. I need you to tell me what Sobel's up to. I've been thinking about that. And what did you come up with? Nothing. Ross popped his trunk and went to stow his laptop. That's what you came up with? Nothing? Everything we've been dealing with so far is a diversion. Bullshit to keep us busy. I went online last night to check out the talk in the taverns of Gadan, forgetting that the feds shut down the Cyberstorm server farm. The taverns of Gadan? It's the biggest port city in Sifrain, a monarchy in Cyberstorm's online game, The Gate. Seebeck just stared at him blankly. Forget that. The point is, The Gate is up and running, Pete. Wait, that's impossible. The feds shut the servers down. In California, yes. But Cyberstorm Entertainment maintains a Chinese mirror site for just such a contingency. It's beyond the reach of U.S. law. Cyberstorm was losing $1 million a day in revenue, so they switched over to the mirror site and filed suit against the FBI in federal court. Filed suit? For what? For unlawfully shutting down their business. The judge will throw it out. Don't count on it. Cyberstorm is a wholly owned subsidiary of a multinational corporation. They have a serious amount of political clout. So, this is what people talk about in the taverns of Gadan? No, that was the Wall Street Journal online. In Gadan, the talk is about the sudden death of the Mad Emperor. Seebeck grimaced. The Mad Emperor? They got that right. Well, his funeral is today. In the real world or the fake one? Both. Seebeck threw up his hands. Ross soldiered on. A power struggle between factions is anticipated for control of the gate. This is a game? Ross nodded. But rituals figure prominently in the gate, as apparently they do in real life. Thus, Sobel's funeral. John, I have no fucking clue what you're talking about. Sobel might be trying to communicate something through his funeral. Okay, now I'm with you. But you don't think he's trying to communicate something to us? Ross shook his head. I'm hoping we're being more perceptive than he anticipated. Let me emphasize, hoping. Well, that's optimistic. Ross looked at his watch. Look, the viewing's in Santa Barbara. That's an hour and a half away. It wouldn't hurt to be early. He gestured for Seebeck to get in on the passenger side. I'll drive. Seebeck glanced at the gleaming Audi A8. Only because my cruiser's wrecked. Ross's Audi raced up the coast on US 101. The morning mist was already clearing, providing a view of the Channel Islands and the offshore oil platforms. It was a gorgeous day. Seebeck settled into the black leather of the passenger seat. The dashboard and door panels were trimmed in burled walnut and brushed steel. So this was what rich people drove. The 12-cylinder engine growled with apparently limitless power as they accelerated past another car on a hill. Seebeck figured this car could give a police interceptor a run for its money. The stereo system alone looked like it could land a 747. John Coltrane's A Love Supreme played on the stereo. Coltrane might as well have been sitting in Seebeck's lap for the quality of the sound. The title and artist displayed in Teutonic yellow dots that scrolled like a Times Square newsflash across the front of the sound console. Seebeck looked over to Ross. I've never seen a stereo like that. Scandinavian, Linux-based DVD audio emulation, 400 gigs. I can store 20,000 songs at 500 times the clarity of a CD.
You have 20,000 songs?
That's not the point.
It isn't.
Hard drive space is cheap. Seebeck just gave him a look. Okay, I'll admit it. I have a technology problem. I'm in a 12-step program.
Seebeck looked around at the car interior again.
How much is a car like this?
About 130, but I talked them down to 120.
Seebeck winced. That was a third higher than his annual salary. A pang of jealousy stole over him. Surely police work was vital. Why did the white-collar professions earn so much more? It was a puzzle to him, one he didn't think he was going to resolve. The Audi raced north, giving him plenty of time to try. Ross had a turn-by-turn map to the funeral home, but they could just have easily followed the satellite news trucks. As they drove past the manicured front lawn of the funeral home, the parking lot overflowed with camera-ready protesters holding up signs reading, "Burn in hell, Sobel!" American flags and yellow ribbons, while still others bore banners with anarchy symbols and pentagrams. It was a flea market of anger. Police and reporters with microphones vied with each other, alternately shoving back competing protesters and interviewing them. The side streets leading to the funeral home were blocked off by SBP traffic cops and sawhorses. No cars were allowed in. Ross turned to Seebeck.
I'm not sure about this. This is where I come in. Pull up to the roadblock.
Ross turned into the side street, and two policemen held up their hands to stop them, then pointed back at the main street. Seebeck lowered his passenger window and showed his badge. One of the cops came up to the window. Seebeck spoke with authority.
Detective Sergeant Seebeck, Ventura County Sheriff's Office. I was heading the murder investigation in Thousand Oaks.
Welcome to Santa Barbara, Sergeant. I saw you on the news. Park around back.
He waved to the other cop to move the barrier aside. The first cop leaned down to Seebeck again.
The feds are running the show inside.
Seebeck nodded and motioned for Ross to drive on through. They entered the funeral home through the rear door. After a brief discussion with federal agents at the door, one of them peeled off to escort them to the chapel. As they moved through the rear hallways, the acrid smell of embalming chemicals and cleansers assaulted them. Men and women in suits were everywhere, going through files and computers in side offices and interviewing a man who appeared to be a mortician in a lab coat. Soon, they passed through a double set of automated doors that led out onto an ornate hallway with marble-tiled floors. They could hear funerary music playing ahead, and another doorway brought them through a side entrance into a church-like room with a podium, rows of pews, mountains of flowers, and a raised dais whereupon sat a bronze coffin on a pedestal draped in white satin. The lid of the coffin was partitioned for viewings, and the upper portion was raised, although the body within could not be seen from this vantage point. Everyone in the place looked like an FBI agent, including the dozen or so people sitting in the nearly empty pews up front. A crime scene photographer was busy taking photos of the room from every angle, although it wasn't apparent what crime was being committed just now. Apparently, the feds didn't want to wait. Ross gestured to the coffin.
"Behold the devil himself!"
The FBI agent escorting them excused himself to resume his post, leaving Seebeck and Ross standing in the doorway relatively alone. The sonorous tones of funeral muzak were punctuated by the occasional squawking of police radios. Seebeck glanced around the room. It was remarkably unremarkable. Tapestries depicting generic salvation, lots of light beams coming from on high, hung down between the unexceptional stained glass windows. A stylized statue of Jesus stood at the head of the chapel, set into an alcove. It was eroded in a modern art sort of way to render it theologically inoffensive, and appeared to be fashioned out of cheap imitation stone resin, stuff that would last until the second coming. Its hands were outstretched like an Australian rules football referee signaling a goal, with robes hanging down. The room was modern and provided no sense of history or permanence. The floor sounded hollow under the heels, and on the whole, the room reminded him more of a library annex than a chapel. It was sterile and unfeeling, except for the banks of flowers, all white lilies, which, through their sheer numbers, answered the unasked question, "How many white lilies can you cram on to this stage?" "This many." An easel to the left of the coffin held a foam core poster of Matthew Sobel, in younger and saner days. He looked like an accountant or an insurance broker. His hair was short and dusty brown. He was smiling good-naturedly, seemingly oblivious to the fact that he would kill 15 people, most of them law officers. An eternal flame, which someone had spitefully extinguished or never lit, stood next to the easel on the trestle table. Apparently, the authorities had a different eternal flame in mind for Sobel. Scattered around the room in groups of two and three were what looked to be FBI agents. Seebeck felt sure they were trying to figure out a way to declare a funeral illegal. Certainly Seebeck felt like putting Sobel's body through a mulcher. Ross tapped his shoulder. "I want to see him." Seebeck nodded, and they both stepped out across the pews. All eyes turned on them. Carpeting absorbed most of the sound of their footfalls, but they still seemed deafening in the stillness of this place. Ross nodded to serious-looking men who watched them pass. The men stared back. Seebeck led Ross to the dais steps. They ascended slowly, and as they did, the mortal remains of Matthew Sobel came into view from beyond the rim of the coffin. Seebeck came here filled with hate. He despised this diseased freak who had slain Deputy Larson and all the others. He was wholly unprepared for his reaction upon first sight of Sobel's corpse. Sobel was practically a skeleton already. It was shocking how the cancer had wasted him away. His disease was readily apparent from the massive scar tracing along the left side of his bald head. It looked like they had opened his skull to attempt surgical resection. The scar was so long, it descended to the orbital socket of Sobel's left eye, where a black patch indicated that his eye had been removed. No other effort had been made to make Sobel presentable. His cheeks were sunken and pale, his neck lost in the spaciousness of a stiff white shirt collar and a Victorian jacket and tie. His dead hands clutched a golden cross against his chest. Most alarming of all was Sobel's one remaining eye, oddly open and staring milky blue at the ceiling. It was a window to madness and terror. Nothing had prepared Seebeck for this. A seed of pity took root in him. Sobel had endured the tortures of the damned. Surely Seebeck wanted Sobel to burn in hell. But he'd never considered Sobel had been living in hell for some time already. Ross croaked, "Jesus." A woman spoke from behind them. "What did you expect to find, Mr. Ross?" Ross and Seebeck spun around to regard a young black woman sitting in the first pew. She was neither beautiful nor unattractive. She wore an immaculate dark blue pantsuit, but she did not have the telltale earphone of the feds. A white guy sat in the pew behind her, leaning forward to join her symbolically. He had buzz-cut blonde hair and wore a dark plaid sports jacket and a black sweater. He didn't look uncomfortable in the jacket, but somehow the jacket appeared uncomfortable with him. Ross looked to Seebeck and then back to the woman. "Do I know you?" "No, but I know you. You're John Frederick Ross, son of Harold and Ivana. Graduated with honors, 1999, from the University of Illinois at Urbana with a master's in computer science. President and CEO of Cyberon Systems, Inc., a one-man Delaware service corporation founded in 2003. She reached into her jacket pocket and produced a badge folder. "Natalie Phillips, National Security Agency." "Oh, shit." Ross looked to nearby Jesus for mercy. Seebeck stepped in. "I'm trying to keep John's name out of the news. He's worried that Sobel will come after him."
"Interesting." She stood up and approached the dais. "Egotistical, but interesting."
She was lean and fit, probably about 30 years old. Seebeck couldn't help but notice her body and cursed his libido. She gestured to the coffin.
I'm surprised you'd come here if you thought Sobel was after you. He might have packed the coffin with C4.
Ross stepped away from the casket warily. She laughed.
Relax. We T-rayed it and swept the whole chapel for computers and wireless transmitters. Came up empty.
She walked up and stood looking over Sobel's remains.
Apparently, Sobel anticipated his unpopularity and left behind a program to carry out his funeral arrangements.
Seebeck frowned.
The demon did this?
It ordered the deluxe package from the funeral home's webpage, but it never had direct control over these objects. Just-in-time inventory. The coffin was built by Bates Corporation yesterday and shipped overnight by truck. We tailed it the whole way. The lilies arrived this morning. This is the mortuary equivalent of a number two combo.
Ross extended his hand. Agent Phillips?
She took it.
Seebeck extended his hand, too.
Detective.
Sergeant Peter Seebeck, she finished for him. My condolences on the deaths of your colleagues. It must be very hard to see this psycho in the flesh.
Seebeck nodded.
What's left of him?
He looked down at the body.
I didn't expect him to look so...
pitiful?
Yeah.
Phillips viewed Sobel's remains too. She gestured to the cross.
They say he found religion in the end.
A cold laugh came out of Seebeck.
I thought crosses burned vampires.
Ross changed the subject.
What's the NSA doing up here, Agent Phillips? Isn't the big investigation down in Thousand Oaks?
I'm not a field agent. I'm a steg analyst.
Ross nodded, then answered Seebeck's quizzical look.
She finds hidden messages. Terrorists and drug traffickers sometimes hide data inside JPEGs and other computer files.
I won't ask why you know that. My own parents don't understand what I do.
So what brings a steg analyst to Sobel's funeral?
Symbolism. Sobel's games are packed with symbols, and I'm not convinced all of them are harmless.
What's that got to do with his funeral?
What's a funeral but a symbolic ritual? He's sending a message, maybe to us, maybe to someone else.
Perhaps. One thing's for sure, it got us all here.
She nodded grimly.
Yes, but it looks like the feds have scared off anyone else.
Ross leaned in close.
You're trying to identify the demon's components, aren't you?
The buzzcut guy bristled in the pews.
Dr. Phillips, remember your directive.
Ross stepped back.
Who's he?
Hard to say. I just call him the Major.
The Major didn't respond. He just stared.
Phillips stepped into Ross's line of sight.
Mr. Ross, you played 347 hours of the gate in the last year. That makes you the only Cyberstorm game expert cleared by the FBI. You're on my list of people to talk to. As long as you're here, I've got a lot of questions about the MMORPG subculture.
347 hours? That's embarrassing.
Seebeck smirked.
You need to get a life, John.
Phillips pressed on.
What's your level of knowledge concerning the Ego AI and Cyberstorm 3D graphics engines?
You think Sobel's hidden components of the demon in his games?
Think texture maps.
Ah, well, there'll be thousands of them.
There are. That's not including custom maps created by individual users with the map editor.
But why would Sobel bother? He could just as easily hide scripting files on some forgotten server. There's no reason to hide anything inside his games.
Sobel's AI engine and Cyberstorm's graphics codecs power a dozen popular games. You can understand why I'm pursuing this angle. They encompass tens of millions of installs worldwide.
Have you interviewed Cyberstorm programmers?
We polygraph them all.